What up, everybody? It's your boy, Duke. And this is the Talking Soccer Podcast, episode 52. And we have a special interview coming up for you later in the show. Jason Longshore, who we'll give the big intro to once we get to the interview, is coming on, color commentator for Atlanta United. But of course, we're going to talk about Champions League action because it is Wednesday afternoon. The games have just finished up. Your boy took an absolute pounding on Juventus. But before we get to that, as always, I'm your host, Duke. You can find me on Twitter at DukeDFS, on Instagram at DukeDFS underscore question mark. I think it's just DukeDFS underscore. We'll have to see. But this is the Talking Soccer Podcast. We are presented by EliteFantasy.com. That's where you can find all of mine and everyone else's DFS content over there. And of course, EliteSportsBetting.com, where, like I mentioned, we took a big position on Juventus today. I got some bad information. And we took an L. But boy, oh boy, do we have a good weekend this past weekend. 5-0-1. And I say that only because I'm not going to list out every single bet. We did two-team and three-team round robins on all of these different bets and hit the parlay for a 17-unit win weekend. So if you haven't yet, get on over there to EliteSportsBetting.com. Make sure you sign up for the VIP package. That's access to me and all my soccer information, as well as NBA, NCAA. We have March Madness coming up. Tommy G is absolutely on fire. Frank Brank, Fried Egg Pauly, everyone's going nuts over there. Mad Lab with MMA has been perfect on three straight cards. Esports is killing it. Hockey's going nuts. If you name it, we got it. No pickleball. No highlight. We do have a tennis guy now. Come on over and check it out. But we did just finish up Champions League action, which means through, I guess, the first leg in all these different games, we have results. Obviously, to go back to last week, Atalanta beats Valencia 4-1. Very big leg up there. Tottenham in shambles. Leipzig up 1-0 with the road goal there. And then this week, we go to yesterday. Chelsea, Bayern Munich. And look, I want to talk about this briefly. We're not going to preview this week's EPL contest. There's just too much to get to, and I want to save time for Jason. Weird line movement prior to this match. The line came down about 30, 40 points back towards Chelsea. I'm looking at it going, what in the hell? How does this make any sense? I made Bayern Munich about minus 150 favorite on the road. Chelsea, obviously in terrible form of late, have now benched their $70 million keeper in Kepa and bring in the old man, Willie Caballero. And I'm looking at this lineup going, okay, well, I like Davies better than Alonso. I like Lewandowski better than Christensen. I like Thiago, better than Kovacic. You look position by position. Bayern has the edge at every single spot. We took a big position on Bayern yesterday. How'd that work out? 3-0 victory, three road goals, nine shots total for Chelsea, and that was with their pressure at the end of the first half. 16 for Bayern Munich, six shots on goal, six big chances created. Honestly, it should have been more. 3-0 was a flattering scoreline to Chelsea Football Club. And what I didn't like, if I'm a Chelsea fan, what I did not like to see was Frank Lampard arms crossed on the bench as Bayern continued to pour it on. I don't want to see that. I want to see you up telling your players how to adjust, moving players from play to play, kicking every ball like a Diego Simeone, who we talked about last week. I don't want to see you brow furrowed, arms crossed on the bench, super hardo, fat Frank Lampard. No, no. Not when you know, heading back to Allianz Arena, you're not going to get a result there. So this is tied on. Bayern Munich through to the next round. Now, how about the other game? Napoli, Barcelona. But before we move on, unfortunately, Robert Lewandowski has hurt. He'll be out for 4 weeks, it looks like. Likely to miss the return leg, as well as a few games here in the Bundesliga, which they're in a very tight race in that right now at the top. Other game yesterday, Napoli hosting Barcelona. Barcelona do get the away goal 1-1, but Arturo Vidal, what are you doing, bud? 89th minute, yellow card. 89th minute, another yellow card for a foul, and then the argument gets sent off. Barcelona are going to be very, very shorthanded in this return leg with Napoli. Sergio Busquets picked up a yellow card. He's now suspended for the second leg. Vidal, obviously, is going to miss. Dembele is hurt. He's out for the year. Luis Suarez is hurt. He's out for the year. I mean, how much can you rely on Lionel Messi to get you through? To me, before the red card, to Vidal, even though Busquets was going to be out, This was Barcelona through to the next round. They picked up their away goal in the 57th minute through Antoine Griezmann, and beautiful buildup and ball from Semedo. If they can just hold this, that's tie done. They go back to Barca, get the victory, and move on. Now it's totally up in the air. Napoli, super solid game plan. Look, only had the ball 33% of the time, but they only gave up 8 shots to Barcelona. They only got 2 shots on target, 0 in the first half, if my memory serves me correct. Napoli, 4 shots on goal, created 1 big chance, get 1 big goal. That's all it takes. A mistake at the back, boom. Zielinski's in, finds Mertens at the top of the box. Golazo from Dries Mertens to get the 1-1 draw there. Look, Napoli, I'm sure, would have loved to keep the clean sheet. That's exactly how they played it. And without Koulibaly, thought it was an extremely impressive defensive effort. Went under the 2.5. We lost that bet, but boy, oh boy, did we clean up on Bayern in that Chelsea game. So fast forward to today. We have the information that we took from the Bayern game. We're looking at this Juventus game. All right, Lyon is hosting Juventus. Juventus, staple in the European Championship. Tons of experience in the attack, and the defense. You could say, but Chesney's a bit questionable in the goal, but back to front, solid team. Much better than Lyon. And then I got some bad information. I was told that this game would be played in an empty stadium. I Googled it. Found a couple articles. Lyon-Juventus to be played behind closed doors, which again implies an empty stadium. I should have done more research. I turned the game on. Boy, that wasn't an empty stadium. Tons of people just sitting in those seats cheering on the Lyonnais of Olympic Lyonnais. And they get the first goal, and they get the win. 1-0. So we lost our over 2. We lost Juventus, unfortunately. And then we lost a live bet. Juventus plus 0.5 goal. And I don't know what the hell happened here, because if you go to the stats, 64% possession, 14 shots for Juventus, 0 on goal. 0 on goal. And you know what that reminds me of? Liverpool, Atletico Madrid. We go to their stats, 73% possession, 8 shots, 0 on goal. So two very similar game plans set up by Simeone and Lyon here from Atletico, and then Lyon. Two very similar results. 1-0 wins for the home side. Crucially, no away goal for Juventus. Certainly going to be an interesting game as they head back to Turin here for the second leg. But the game of the day had to be Real Madrid, Man City. I actually had a separate bet, a side bet, with one of my subs about the possession stats on this game. I thought Man City would have the majority of the ball. They did. I thought Man City would create the majority of chances. They did. I did not think Madrid would take the lead and then concede it late. And that's exactly what happened. You look at it, everything's going to plan. You get to the 60th minute, it's still 0-0. Vinicius picks up a poor touch, takes on two defenders, crosses a little slotted ball to Isco, who's 1-0 as Ederson gets off his line, slots it side netting. 1-0 Real Madrid. All right, everybody, just contain. Let's just keep it where it's at. Keep the zero. Kevin De Bruyne having a 0 out of 10 game. Of course he does, is the difference. 78th minute, takes it towards the end line, facing away from goal, pivots slightly, clips a ball towards the back post. Gabby Jesus with just the slightest little push off Sergio Ramos to create that space, snaps his header down, 1-1, 78th minute. Just 5 minutes later, Raheem Sterling, who's come on just 10 minutes prior, takes on Carvajal on the side. And Carvajal, what are you doing, brother? What are you doing, man? Sterling's going nowhere. He's getting to the end line. It's slightly out of control. One of those where the ball is pushed a little bit too far. They both go for it, but Sterling's pace is the difference. Gets there, touches it. It's one of those where he touches it, and there's no way in hell he's going to get to it. But he got there first, and Carvajal cleans him out. Penalty to Man City. De Bruyne steps up. And we know City have had so many issues from the penalty spot, steps up, cool as you like, face red as a beet, buries it, boom, to the left, his left, Courtois' right, as Courtois dives the opposite direction. First of all, unbelievable game from Courtois, a bit unlucky not to get at least a draw there, if not a win, considering all he'd done up until that point, but bravo to Pep, we know the importance that this season's Champions League has on Man City's short-term and long-term future, knowing full well they'll be banned from the next 2 years of the competition. So, bravo to City for the big victory today over Real Madrid. And that's not it. 86 minutes, Sergio Ramos with a professional foul just outside the box. He and Varane, sixes and sevens at the back. Jesus in on goal. Ramos takes him down just outside the box. Red card. He'll be gone for the next leg of this crucial, crucial match as they head back to Manchester with not only a 2-1 lead, but two away goals in hand. Madrid going to have to get a victory at Man City. Fun, fun times over the last 2 weeks and certainly over the last 2 days. Again, unbelievable weekend over this past weekend. 5-0-1 plus 17 unit weekend. More of that to come this weekend with EPL action. We do have a relatively full slate. Bit of an odd slate on Saturday with the three games at 10 and the one at 12:30. I'll have an article out on elitefantasy.com detailing all of those games, all of the best DFS plays on elitefantasy.com on Thursday. FPL articles out on Friday. Sunday Funday article will be out on Saturday for Sunday's action. I'll be in the chat rooms all weekend. It's going to be a fun time as we build that bankroll and head towards March Madness. But now we got to bring on our guest, and it's great timing because Tuesday evening, Atlanta United wins 3-0 to advance to the round of eight in the CONCACAF Champions League. Ladies and gentlemen, formerly the chief development officer of Soccer in the Streets, he hosts a show daily, right? Soccer Down Here daily on Blog Talk Radio. Jason Longshore, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, good. How are you?
And by the way, that's the short version of all of his accomplishments. This dude is anything in and around Atlanta soccer or soccer in general. He's our go-to man. So thanks for joining us. And I got to say, congratulations on all of your success you've had establishing yourself in this industry. Seriously, it's awesome. There's not very many positions and you are the main man. So congrats to you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm lucky. I've been really lucky to, you know, build up a relationship with a great club like Atlanta United. I worked with them when I was at Soccer in the Streets, and to have the opportunity to call matches on radio. And look, not every MLS team has the radio like we do, and especially doesn't get to travel like we do. And we're very lucky at 92.9 The Game that the program director, Terry Fox, and the assistant program director, Sean Thompson, put so much towards covering Atlanta United and soccer in general in the way that it should be.
And top to bottom from the roster, I know Mike Bell and all those guys are super into it. Really cool to see the city of Atlanta just adopt this team as their own before existence, right? And is that kind of how you got your start with Atlanta United? You mentioned Soccer in the Streets. You know, I remember way back, it might have been a preseason game or something similar. I believe you and Mike Conti were doing a game, and I thought it was very informal, not official yet. And I thought, well, this is a good idea. I should do something like this so maybe I can get hooked up with Atlanta United. Like 2 days later, you were announced as the team, and I thought, all right, there goes my plans.
It was kind of wild. We didn't know what was going to happen with radio, and John Nelson and I, it was actually John and I who went out and did one of the Carolina Challenge Cup games, ESPN Coastal down in Savannah, Brunswick. They got the rights to that Charleston tournament, and we called the Seattle preseason match. Mm-hmm. And it was right before the season started that everything came into place with 92.9 The Game. And I got the opportunity a few days before the first match. And it's just been a wild ride. I mean, I've been lucky that I've done a lot of different things in the soccer community in Atlanta. My resume is kind of a different one. I didn't play professionally, but I've worked with professional clubs. I was the operations director with the Atlanta Ruckus, media relations with the Ruckus going back to the old A-League days. Worked with the Silverbacks in a number of different roles, helped run the reserve team, also was involved in game day ops for the first team in the later NASL time. And just the connections with Soccer in the Streets, you know, a nonprofit that is respected around the world. And when Atlanta United launched, they reached out to us, and Soccer in the Streets was able to create some great partnerships for the club. And really take something off of the club's plate, because it's one thing to start a world-class team from scratch. When you have to get into community programming, that can be difficult. It takes a lot of time. And to have an organization like Soccer in the Streets and to build that relationship was very cool. I think it's been rewarding for both sides. So, you know, doing that put me in contact with Darren Eales and Ann Rodriguez and later Katie Griggs and the rest of the crew, and Carlos Bocanegra when he was hired. And just building those relationships made it where I was in the mix when the opportunity came on radio and got the opportunity, and I've held onto the mic ever since.
Don't let go, because someone will be there to take it, Jason. But you know, you mentioned a really interesting thing there. It is something that bugs me quite a bit when we look at analyst positions across all sports, but especially soccer. You look at, you know, the old pro, right? Who's done it, who's been on the national team, who has 50 caps, who's played overseas. Is that necessary to be able to do your job effectively? I mean, I think quite honestly, coming from the coaching world myself, the best players rarely make the best coaches. And I think the prerequisite of national team experience or being a face or a name, it limits the pool of talent. And you're a shining example of someone who didn't have that background, but is fantastic at your job.
It can. I think there's great players who go into the broadcast world. I just don't think there's necessarily a blueprint for it. You know, some are able to make that transition. Some are able to make that transition to the coaching side. Somebody like Carlos Bocanegra has been able to make that transition in a great way to a general manager, technical director kind of side and shape a club. And some, you know, that's not the route for them and they find other things. Some go into the academy side. There's plenty of great players who don't go into first team coaching and end up working, you know, with the U-12s, U-13s in an academy and have a huge impact. There's just not one way to do it. And I'm lucky that Darren Eales and Matt Moore at Atlanta United made the decision to take a chance on me. And I've, like I said, I've just run with it. I have to call the game a little differently because I don't have those things to fall back on. I don't have the, you know, the stories from being in the locker room or the firsthand knowledge of these things. So I have to lean a lot on history. I have to lean a lot on, you know, studying and working hard to know what's going on around the league and know the storylines and be able to tell the stories of every single match. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of prep, but it's a lot of fun and it's so rewarding to get a chance to do it and to be part of, you know, what soccer is becoming in Atlanta. And I think we're lucky at 92.9 that Mike and I both have a soccer background, but we're also not limited to soccer. So we're able to kind of cross over to Falcons fans and Hawks fans and Braves fans who are jumping on board with this new soccer thing. And we're not an overwhelming, you know, voice. We're not an overwhelming thing there because we can relate it to, you know, Miguel Almiron's speed is like Michael Vick. You know, we can make that comparison where maybe some others in the soccer world either aren't comfortable doing that or don't see the value in it. We have, you know, our fan base is everybody, brand new fans who are at their first game, listening to their first game, and people who played professionally, you know, for 20 years. We get everybody listening to our matches, so we try to serve them all.
And that deep knowledge base is why we had you on here. We're going to talk MLS in general. It's going to be pretty much an Atlanta United specific podcast. We'll do some generalities. And let's start with this. The new MLS theme song was released today. I love it. That thing got me jacked up, man. I'm a put the Champions League theme song in my, you know, baby daughter's crib at night kind of guy. This is just below that, Jason. Have you had a chance to hear it?
Yeah, I love it. I saw it debut this morning and we actually played it on soccer down here this morning. And I kind of got goosebumps a little bit because it sounds like MLS should sound.
Yeah.
You know, like I think it's easy to hear what the Bundesliga does or what the Premier League does or even the Champions League theme song and say, okay, let's do our version of that. This isn't like that at all. This sounds like MLS. And that's what you need. You need something identifiable. I love it. I think they nailed it.
Well, Atlanta United has certainly carved out an identity in the league here. And before we get into questions about those, I don't even know if you know how deep my roots go with Atlanta United, but I actually played for Academy Director Tony Annan. I was roommates with Liam Curran in college at Xavier, the new goalkeeper coach. I coached Brendan Moore. So look, I'd be a fan regardless. I'm a founding member, but my blood, sweat, and tears, literally my buddies are in this team here. So I live and die with them every year. You have to put up with me on Twitter after games when I've had a few too many soda pops, but nothing better than last night's result. Let's start there, Jason. Big 3-0 win last night for Atlanta United in the CONCACAF Champions League. You were on the call with Mike Conte. What'd you like? What'd you see? What'd you not like? Obviously, Pitti and Barco looked sharp to me for this early in the season. They were basically, for periods of the time last year, non-existent for major parts. Barco obviously going off with his youth national team and Pitti getting used to the league. Big boost to our attack. But overall thoughts on last night's game?
I love this attacking trio, and I love that Frank DeBoer has the guts to play two playmakers, because not many managers do. Usually one of them would get thrown out wide and you'd want to keep things very secure. But to play in the way Atlanta played last night, this 3-4-3 with honestly two number 10s, it's kind of a box midfield with the two 10s in front of two central midfielders. It's gutsy, and it's going to look, you know, disjointed at times. But when it's flowing, it's beautiful. I love creative soccer, and to have two guys who approach the playmaker role in a different way, like Barco and Pitti, it's just so much fun to watch when they're on, and they were on last night. Motagua helped out a little bit. I thought they were a little too defensive coming in. I get the mentality, but 5-4-1, where, you know, in the first leg, they hurt Atlanta a little bit by getting down the flanks, especially on the right side. I thought maybe they'd have at least two up top and have somebody for Roberto Moreira to play off of. Made it a little easier for Atlanta, but dominant performance. I think we saw a lot of glimpses of what Atlanta can be in 2020. There's still room to grow. There's still things that can be better, and there's honestly some pieces that are still missing. Miles Robinson out injured, and I really like the Brazilian central midfielder, Matheus Osetu. When he's in this mix, I think he gives you another attacking dynamic.
Well, let's talk about the turnover in the roster. Obviously, it's a big talking point across the league here. Atlanta United, we've basically dismantled our championship team, but let's talk specifics. Atlanta United out. Gonzalez Perez gone. Nagby gone. Gressel gone. Vialba gone. Miram gone. I mean, that would be the top five players on several teams in the league this year. So, I mean, do we have direct replacements for this? Is Heinemann moving into that permanent role from Bournemouth? Is he filling that Nagby gap?
You know what's interesting, when you look at those names that are gone and you look at the way that the team handled some of the potential departures, because some were expected, some were unexpected, some were maybe 50-50. Gressel, for example, 50-50, because you knew you were trying to sign him to a new deal. There had been offers made. He hadn't accepted it. You went out and you got Brooks Lennon, you know, early in the offseason as cover for that position. Brooks Lennon, I think, gives you some elements of what Julian Gressel did, but also some different things that can allow this team to play a little differently. You look at Emerson Heinemann last year, and it was the same thing. There were offers made to Darlington Nagby on long-term deals. He had said no. You go out and you bring in Heinemann on loan. You like what you see, and you bring him in on a permanent basis. Is he a direct replacement? I mean, in a roster spot on paper, sure. Is he a direct replacement on the field? He's different. He's a different player. I think he's probably a little more comfortable dropping deeper than Nagby was. Nagby feels more like a true number eight, whereas Heinemann can play the eight, the 10, a little bit of the six. We haven't seen the six as much here, but I wonder if he gets paired up with Osetu, if he'd play more of the defensive role of that midfield pair. Leandro Gonzalez Perez, I don't think was expected at all. I think it was an offer that came that was too good for him to pass up and too good eventually for the club to pass up. I think ultimately in all of these deals that the club had control over, either in a transfer or a trade situation, they did right by the player and got maximum value back for the club in that as well. And you have to do that these days because word gets around. You know, if you hold a guy, and Bocanegra talked about this with Gressel, if you hold a guy and you offer the option, or you offer a bona fide offer and you keep their rights, you limit their opportunities. And they didn't want to do that with Gressel. They got a big trade. They already had Lennon, so they had cover. Leandro Gonzalez Perez, Bocanegra talked about it at the same time. Last year, there were offers. The club said no. And LGP's representation said that if there was an opportunity for him to make more money, that they would be interested in hearing it. And you would assume that was the case here, and that's why the deal ended up getting done, because the conversation around that, and I know a lot of people zeroed in on what was said last year at the All-Star game, the conversation from LGP at the end of the season and in the offseason did not sound like a player on his way out at all. He gave an interview with Teise in Argentina where he, you know, shouted the praises of MLS and Atlanta United and how happy he was and how it's a league that you don't want to leave. And then he ended up leaving because it's a good offer for him. You know, at that age, you have to make the most of your opportunity to make money. Whether you're Julian Gressel, whether you're Leandro Gonzalez Perez, whether you're Darlington Nagby, Tito Vialba wanted more playing time. That wasn't going to be a guarantee. He gets a chance to go back to Libertad in Paraguay and earn time with the Paraguayan national team. the players got something out of these deals. The club got something out of these deals. It's what we see around the world. Maybe it's the first time we've seen it to this degree in MLS.
Yeah, I think it's, and it's been a theme from minute one, right? We think back to Carlos Comona, them allowing him to leave late in the offseason, Almiron getting his move to Europe, you know, moving Gressoan, like you mentioned. And it's interesting for me to hear that LGP was not a planned move, because for me,
bringing in Mesa
and LGP leaving is a Frank DeBoer move. I know for myself, I go to the games with my dad every single week. We're always talking at halftime, who's doing what. LGP gets bored. He just gets bored back there. It's too simple with the system that they're playing, and he tries a hero pass, breaking two lines. All of a sudden, the opponent intercepts it, and they're in on goal. That, to me, seemed like a safety and solidity move with perhaps maybe some upside talent in Mesa versus the leadership, the toughness, and what LGP brought to the table. But you're saying this wasn't a planned move.
I don't think so. It didn't appear that way. If you want to look back at the first back line, now I think Atlanta's going to play more three in the back this year than probably ever before, more of a 3-4-3. But you look at the original center back pairing for Atlanta United with Michael Parkhurst, Leandro Gonzalez, Pires. LGP talked about it last year when Parkhurst's time waned and it was LGP and Robinson. He said that he was in the daddy role now. He was the organizer, and Robinson was kind of the replacement for him. Take that the next step. Fernando Meza is far more of a Michael Parkhurst replacement in the way he plays,
right,
the personality he has on the field. So you're back to an athlete in Miles Robinson, a physical presence, a different kind of physical presence than Gonzalez Pires, but still physical, and an organizer, a calm head, and a veteran in Fernando Meza like you had with Parkhurst.
Interesting. So what should we expect from Josetu? Because I'm watching Rometty and Hyman last night. They did a job, but I think it was maybe the 25th, 26th minute. Hyman tries to play a square ball to Rometty, misses him by 3 or 4 yards as they're playing out of the back. All of a sudden, Motagua, who has nothing going for him, is in on goal. I think those two together is not the way forward. Are we expecting him to fill one of those two roles, perhaps with Hyman, or is he going to play further up the field as support for Pitti and Barco?
I think he has every potential to play as one of those central midfielders, but I don't know if we're going to see a dedicated pair that starts 30 times together. I do think we're going to see some rotation because Larenowitz will get some starts against certain opponents. I think Mo Adams has an opportunity to get some starts against certain opponents as more of a defensive presence, a pure six kind of role. Rometty's a guy who can play the six, but he can also play more the eight and push forward. Hyndman, it's funny, that one pass, that was his only incomplete pass of the night.
He's so conservative, Jason. That's why I'm worried.
At times, he can be.
And you need that, right? You need that, especially in this system. I worry about, and maybe you don't need to, because you have the likes of Pitti and Barco up front. I worry about the creativity from that two. If that two's there simply to protect the back three, collect the ball, cycle it left and right and forward to our playmakers, I'm all for that. If Josetu can get in there and provide a little bit deeper creativity, because I don't think Hyndman doesn't lack the ability, but just lacks the mental capacity to play a dangerous pass. He's so simple at times, which is hard to do, and it helps the team, but he plays so simple.
I think Hyndman in that deeper role, he is different. But think back to last year at times when we saw him play higher up the field and he was the forward most of the midfield three. He was making that splitting pass. He was creating in the final third. I think it's a little bit of the role is different in this. And yeah, it's more protective. You know, it's, you want to, in a perfect world, produce enough with your front three, with Pitti, with Barco, with Joseph, to where you can defend with seven. And if your three can be that good up front and defend with seven, you're going to win most of your matches and you're going to do it comfortably.
You know, it's funny. I'm looking through my list of questions here. I have nothing on Joseph because he's just awesome. He's just the best in the league at what he does. And there's so many other question marks. Let's have you be a genius here and predict the future. Will George Bello stay healthy this year?
I hope so. This concussion is completely different than any other injuries he's had. I think people have lumped them all together, and this is just could happen to anybody. It was a lot scarier looking in Birmingham than it ended up being. There was concern because he was strapped to a a backboard, that there could have been some kind of physical damage. None of that. It was a concussion. He's actually back training, so that's a good sign. But you know how concussions can go. It's kind of touch and go. It is a total day-to-day process. I think Bello, if healthy, is the best option on the left side, because I think he gives you the best combination of defending plus getting forward and making things happen in the final third. Castillo is probably the safest option on the left side. He's more of a true left back, I think. Bello is still getting better defensively. You know, he's young. He's still got room to grow there. Mulroney's a really interesting combination of speed, pure speed. Might be the fastest player in the team right now. And ability in the final third. I really like his 1v1 ability. Defensively, is he going to be strong enough? And that's the question mark for me with him. Bello, in my opinion, has every opportunity to be the starter by the end of the season. How long does it take him to get there? His concussion just set it back a little bit, but with Castillo's injury, it still feels like it's wide open on the left side. I like that you've got three different kinds of players, because it's going to push Bello to get better. It's going to push him to get the most out of his game. Castillo knows what his role is, a little bit of mentoring. Bello, also a guy who can, you know, be a safe play in certain opportunities. Mulroney's a guy who can play on either side and is going to find his opportunities because of his speed. Bello is the most complete. And I really hope that what I've been able to see with Atlanta United 2 more often than with the first team, I hope that translates to the first team level very soon and he can stay healthy. I think the recurring issues with the groin, he had surgery to deal with that. He played, I want to say, 10 times with Atlanta United 2 at the end of last season with no issues, and then went to the U17 World Cup. So I think that part's fine. The concussion, you just got to get back from it and see where he is.
Assuming everyone's healthy, Castillo, the starting left back on this team, or left wing back, or left mid, whatever we're playing?
Right now, I think so. Now, that could be different in a couple of months. I think Bello has the shot to pass him. I think Mulroney's in the mix too. But right now, if you were in a must-win situation, I think Castillo's the safest play.
One of the things I've been extremely impressed about, first of all, from start to finish, Atlanta United's been first class. Arthur Blank's been first class. Darren Eales, Carlos Bocanegra, the whole team has been first class. But the plan that's laid out as they develop their academy players into Atlanta United 2, into the first team and beyond, is second to none. I saw a, you know, hour-long presentation from Tony Annan on the process. And I love young players. We all do, right? Potential's great. That's why, you know, 7-foot high school kids used to get drafted out of high school in the NBA. I love George Bello. Are we done with Andrew Carlton at Atlanta United?
I don't think so. I think Carlton has an opportunity to go to Indianapolis with a fresh start and show what he can do. I mean, it's hard when you're a teenager and everybody knows you in town and you're the guy. And, I mean, you're the first big local signing. Everyone's counting on you. You get money that you've never seen before. And that's a tough combination of things. I really like Carlton's game. I think from a comparison standpoint, he honestly reminds me a lot of Pity Martinez, in that he is bold and audacious, and he will try things that your average player would not have the guts to try or the ability to try. I don't think he's a speed merchant. I do worry a little bit about his athleticism, but I think as a passer, as a playmaker, as a creator, he's unique. He's a very special player. I think getting away from Atlanta, getting a chance to just play on a regular basis, not being back and forth between the first team and the second team, not sitting the bench with the first team, he has to go and I think make a point with Indy 11. Just like I think a lot of young players do when they go out on loan. You have to go and show your club that has your contract why they should bring you back. And Carlton, I don't think he's done with Atlanta, but I think this is a really big season for him where he needs to show that, hey, he can be in the mix going forward.
Is MLS his level? US or USL his level? What's his level?
I think he's an MLS level player. I think he needs time. I think for me, watching him with the twos over a fairly regular basis over the last couple of years, it's consistency. And I think it's consistency of impacting matches. Last season, the last couple months of the season, when he was kind of with the twos exclusively, I thought was the best he's played as a professional, because he was playing week in, week out with one team, with one group, and he was impacting matches on a regular basis. He was creating multiple chances per game. He was scoring goals. He was assisting on goals. He needs to play. And at Indy, it's a different role for him. He's not going to be a guy who's bouncing around from team to team. He's the guy they're looking to lead them to a championship. It's a different kind of pressure. It's a different kind of expectation. I think he's an MLS guy, but he has to show that at the USL level, he is consistently impacting matches.
Yeah, we need six out of 10, 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10 performances consistently, where I feel like you got some twos and threes thrown in there. And that's probably just down to youth. But look, let's go to the forward position, because this is out of everywhere on the field, outside of on the sideline with Frank DeBoer, and we'll get into that here shortly. Forward is the biggest worry for me. I think Joseph's the best forward in the league. I think he's been incredibly resilient, healthy, and knock on wood, he will be this year. But God forbid he gets injured. What in the hell do we do at forward? Because look, I liked Brandon Vasquez quite a bit for a young, big, strong player. Finishing needs some work, but I think he'll be fine in the league here. But Adam John, sell me on Adam John, because he sounds like a great guy. Seems like he's fit in with the team well enough. If Joseph is out for an extended period of time, can he do the job?
He's different. And that's what's so hard about it is, you know, with an MLS roster construction, you're never going to have a like for like for a player like Joseph, who's got 90 goals and just over 100 matches in all competitions. You're never going to have a Joseph 2 on the bench. That's the hard part about it. So Adam John is a player that I think this team has honestly lacked since maybe Kenwin Jones. And you're talking about a big number 9 that can be a pure target. And we see it all the time in matches where it's late. You're not going to be able to build up play. You're going to have to get direct. You're going to have to go route one. You're going to have to look for a knockdown. John's a guy who can give you that. I think he can pair with Joseph Martinez against some opponents and give you a different look. I think he's a guy that you can count on in those moments like we saw last season where Joseph was injured. He missed multiple games, and Vasquez had moments here and there, but the consistency wasn't there. John has done it at both levels. He's been a good backup at the MLS level, and smart move to go to Phoenix last year and play and put 17 goals on the board. Really important for him to get those minutes and show that, look, Copa America, Joseph's away. Different moments in the season. If Joseph needs a break, you've got a guy that can come in and give you a good 90-minute shift. Do it differently, but perform.
You know, it's different timelines in their career, right? But similar to exactly what we talked about to Andrew Carleton. Has the ability to play at this level, but maybe drops down a touch, finds his confidence, and gets a second opportunity, a second life in the league. That encourages me a little bit. Thank you. But here, and talk about the manager, the man on the sidelines. Look, you can call me a Frank DeBoer hater if you'd like, but I've come off the ledge a little bit. Certainly wasn't happy early on because I wasn't sure he's willing to change. You know, he came in and looked like, you know, square pegs and round holes a little bit, but he's adjusted his tactics some. We saw with the two number 10s in Pitti and Barco that he's willing to use the pieces that we have to create what we think will be a successful team. But just in general, in MLS, Tata versus Frank, whose style of play is more suited for MLS championships?
I think they both are. I think they're different. It's kind of funny that Tata Martino is looked at as a manager who is big and bold and takes a lot of chances. Honestly, his MO before he came to Atlanta was that he was the pragmatic version of Marcelo Bielsa, not the big risk taker. Frank DeBoer, coming from the Dutch school, is honestly in between the Johan Cruyff version and the Louis van Gaal version. And I know a lot of people get really bent out of shape when you mention Louis van Gaal. I think at times that's unfair. Later in his career, it got a little too rigid at times. But also, a manager like Bielsa, who is respected worldwide, says that the 95 Ajax team that won the Champions League that van Gaal managed and Frank de Boer was a part of was the most organized team in history of the game. and didn't sacrifice, I think, being creative and being a fun team to watch by being organized. You can't have both. I think Frank DeBoer is definitely more willing to change things around than Tata Martino was. It's something that I always remember the criticism coming from fans that Martino never made subs. And the run in 2017 when the Mercedes-Benz Stadium opened, he never changed the lineup. It was always the same lineup. And it was working. So, I mean, he didn't need to change the lineup. But did it come into play at the end of the season where the team was out of gas? Maybe.
Yep.
But you also had to get that playoff spot because that wasn't a guarantee when that run started. So, look, I think every manager has things that are, you know, quirks about them. I think Frank DeBoer got this tag of being rigid. Honestly, I didn't even see it early last season because you go back and look at Monterey. Well, let's go back and start day one. Herediano. He started a teenager in George Bello at left, you know, wing back in a 3-4-3. Monterey. Going into the match in Monterey, Julian Gressel rolled his ankle in training, so he wasn't available. You had to figure out a solution because Franco Escobar was injured as well. And you played Mikey Ambrose as a right wing back because you didn't really have any other options. And it was serviceable. Game got away in the final 10 minutes. You can look at substitutions, and that's one element from last season that I questioned in a big way because I feel like if that game was 1-0, but probably more likely it was going to finish 2-0. You know, Monterey was starting to really get some momentum before that final 10 minutes. I think another goal was likely. At 2-0, it would have felt really different coming back home. 3-0, it was a really tough ask.
And I'll tell you, that's exactly the lead up to me losing my mind as I'm leaving Mercedes-Benz Stadium after a 1-1 draw with an absolutely god-awful FC Cincinnati team. We're coming off the loss to DC United. We get absolutely bent over by Monterey. And then we show zero creativity against an expansion team who at the time I thought was god-awful. And we found out as the season went on was god-awful. This guy is not going to change his ways. I don't even know if I called into the radio station. I was definitely tweeting you after the game. What in the hell are we doing with Frank DeBoer? What are we doing, man? Jason, we just won the championship. But I like what he's doing now. So
yeah, that's the thing. That's it. You know, that was Cincinnati was what game
two.
One, two of the regular season, but mm-hmm. You had the three CONCACAF games.
Yep.
So it was game five, and Franco Escobar was injured. Julian Gressel missed the Monterey game. I think he was back for the Cincinnati game, but he was not 100%. You're still figuring it out. You know, I'll look back, and this is why I really like the 3-4-3 that we're seeing in the early stages of 2020. In my opinion, the best week of 2019 from a quality perspective was winning at home against NYC, winning the Campeones Cup with a heavily rotated lineup,
yep,
and then going to Portland and dominating the Timbers, playing them off the park in their own building. Not just winning it and, you know, stealing a win, dominating the match.
And by the way, on either end of those games, bookend wins against Orlando City. Those clowns. Woo!
It's always fun. Always love that.
Yeah.
But those two games, the Campeones Cup game where you rotated the lineup, different story. But the two MLS games, attacking trio, Pity Martinez, Ezequiel Barco, underneath Joseph Martinez.
Yep.
So for everybody freaking out about 3-4-3 this year, we saw it, and it was good last year because when it was that trio, it didn't play like the 3-5-2 that everybody was very happy about when that shift happened, again, out of necessity. And that's when you have to give Frank DeBoer credit. He turned Justin Merrim into a wingback.
Yeah.
That wasn't something Justin said he never played because he'd always been an attacking winger. You got a 3-5-2 in the game against Houston, and yes, you got lucky because Chris Penzo tossed Albert Ellis very quickly. But you go into that game, I can tell you exactly my thought process from Seattle, leaving the stadium in Seattle where Breck Shea has done his knee. You know it's pretty bad at that point. You know he's not playing on Wednesday because this was a Sunday afternoon game on the West Coast. You're coming back home for a Wednesday game with Houston. You know you don't have Breck Shea. You don't have any options on the left side. And then Franco Escobar got one of the worst yellow cards of the season when he went up and just won a header. And I lose my mind on the radio about it. And he's suspended. So you have no outside backs. You have no wing backs. Nothing. You're able to play Julian Gressel as a wing back. And we had seen that before, and it was really good. He reprised that role effectively. But you turn Merrim into a wing back, and you go to 3-5-2 out of necessity. You have really no time to train on it because you get back into Atlanta late Sunday night. You're just doing regen on Monday. You might have trained it in a walkthrough, and you turn it up and start scoring a bunch of goals. You know, I think a lot of people said that the players changed everything and they demanded things. Frank DeBoer was the one signing the lineup sheet last time I checked. And to be open-minded enough to allow this team to evolve and ride momentum, but also solve problems with kind of unorthodox solutions, I think he didn't get the credit that he should have last year. And I like what he's building this year because it feels more controlling of matches so far. This team has been really good defensively, but they haven't sacrificed numbers going.
All right, Jason, I tell you what, man, let's do this. I'll give you the floor. 10, 15 minutes, however long you want. Just run through the rest of the MLS. I think we've beaten Atlanta United folks over the head with some good stuff here. So East, West, Champions, Golden Boot, whatever. This is mostly a betting podcast. If you can throw some good stuff in at the end on who you think is going to win the Golden Boot and the championship, that'd be great. But here you go, man. The floor is yours. Jason Longshore, go nuts.
All right. I wanted to finish up with a few thoughts on MLS as a whole in 2020. And let's start with just a broad overview of the league, and it's in season number 25. I think it could be a very competitive, very open 25th season for Major League Soccer. In the East, I feel like there could end up being five teams that could make it to MLS Cup. The three obvious ones, in my opinion, are Atlanta, New York City, and Toronto. Atlanta has a ton of attacking talent, maybe the best attacking talent in the league. And I really like where this team is right now with Frank DeBoer, and I think there's a lot of room for it to continue to grow. New York City, doing very well in CONCACAF Champions League, dealing with San Carlos, a fairly weak opponent. They're also handling their managerial change from Domé Tarrant to Ronnie Dyla pretty well. Dyla has the luxury of having all of the key contributors from last season back, and he doesn't have to make any dramatic changes to the way this team played last season. I think Dyla is going to keep New York City in the mix, and you could even say that they might end up being the favorite in the East because of all of that continuity. Toronto's a different conversation altogether. I think Toronto will be there at the end of the day, but I don't know if they end up finishing third in the Eastern Conference during the regular season. Michael Bradley being out early on is going to hurt them. Can Liam Fraser be that replacement in the early going? We'll have to wait and see. I like the other central midfielders with him in Delgado and Osorio. I think they're two very underrated players in this league. Can Pablo Piatti, Alejandro Pozuelo, and Josie Altidore stay healthy? Piatti's already got a little bit of a knock. Can they gel to make that attacking trio one of the better ones in the league? It's a different one in the way it functions in Atlanta, but Toronto could be really effective. And by the time they get Michael Bradley back, I think they'll be a team to beat in the East. The other two that I'm keeping an eye on are Columbus and New England. I think two are the best teams at the end of last season. Columbus missed out on the postseason, but they've gotten even better with Lucas De La Rion. I think Columbus will be a very difficult team to deal with in the Eastern Conference. And New England, who was one of the hottest teams as the season ended last year. Atlanta took care of them in the postseason, but I think they have the potential to be even better with a full year of Bruce Arena at the helm. I don't think they'll be an easy out either. And when you have a player like Gustavo Boe, when you have a player like Carlos Heel, although there are some questions about Carlos Heel at the moment, Gustavo Boe is a supremely talented attacker, so I think New England will be in the mix in the Eastern Conference as well. Other playoff teams, Orlando's going to be better than they've ever been. I think Cincinnati will be a good bit better than they were last year, although the managerial chaos that seems to consume this club continues, so we'll see where that goes. But I think in terms of the roster on paper, it's much, much, much better than it was last year. Philadelphia is one that I think a lot of people are forgetting about. They finished third in the East last year. I do wonder about how they replace Harris Madunyanin. I do wonder if they can be as effective in this next generation of Ernest Tanner's squad. Jim Curtin, you know, keeps the job on a long term. I like that. I think Kasper Schabilko is one of the more underrated attackers in the league. But I don't know if they have gotten better in the offseason, and I feel like a lot of other teams have. I think Philly, if their signings end up, you know, paying off, I think maybe they maintain and they need to find a way to improve. If it's just individuals getting better, they're gonna have to go find more talent. I don't know, but I feel like they have maintained and maybe some teams have passed them in the East. Out West contenders for me, LAFC, I think, has to be one, even with the Walker Zimmerman trade, which I do think throws the Western Conference out of whack just a bit because that hurts them defensively in a big way. Now, they just traded today for the number one spot in the allocation order. Usually you do that when you have something lined up. Do they have a center back coming? How long is it going to take that center back or that right back, I guess, if you want to move Tristan Blackman into the middle? How long is it going to take that person to get here, and how long is it going to take that person to gel with this team? We'll have to wait and see. But I think LAFC will suffer defensively in the early going because they just don't have a replacement for Walker Zimmerman. And honestly, I don't know if they truly have a replacement for Steven Betashore at right back. Blackman is a player who is developing, but he's not Steven Betashore right now. It hurt them in CONCACAF Champions League. It could hurt them in the early going. I don't see them doing what they did last year in terms of point totals and supporter shield. I don't think that's a guarantee. We'll see what they do defensively because they have to add somebody. They just have to add somebody to replace Zimmerman, and how long that takes will affect what their ceiling can be in terms of a point total. There's two other teams in the West that I have high hopes for that I had high hopes for last year and both had problems for different reasons. The Portland Timbers have gotten much, much better, in my opinion. I've always had a lot of respect for Giovanni Savarese as a manager. I do think this is a year that he goes into with a lot of pressure. This is a team that is constructed to be a title contender, and if they're not, questions will be asked. But the additions they've made, I think they're better up front. I think they have enough cover now. You do have to wonder about Diego Valeri and Sebastian Blanco and their effectiveness as another year older. I think they've got enough for Portland to be a much, much better team than they were last year. Are they a MLS Cup kind of team like they were in 2018? I think they could be. But I think another team they're going to have to deal with is Sporting Kansas City. Sporting Kansas City had just awful luck with injuries last year. Many, many times unable to field a full 18 because of injuries. And it was a lot of injuries at the same positions. They have bolstered their center back depth. They have added Alan Pulido up top, the Liga MX Golden Boot winner. So they finally have that number nine that they honestly haven't since they traded Dom Dwyer. Kansas City has to be looked at, in my opinion, as a Western Conference contender. Peter Vermes is one of the best managers in the league. I think he had bad luck last year. I think a lot of people have written them off way too early. Kansas City, in my mind, is one of the teams to beat. Seattle's a team that I do still have some questions about. They have a lot of turnover from last year, and especially defensively. I do wonder about Christian Roldan as an outside midfielder as opposed to playing centrally. I really do like the signing of Joao Paulo, the central midfielder from Botafogo. But defensively, is Seattle going to be good enough? We've always seen it with the Sounders, though. They've started slow. They do have the opportunity to add in the summer window. And will they be there at the end? There's a very good chance of it because Brian Schmetzer has proven, you know, year in and year out that he's a manager who gets the most out of what he has. I just don't know if he has enough to deal with LAFC, to deal with Portland, to deal with Kansas City, to potentially deal with the LA Galaxy. Chicharito, in my opinion, makes them a better team than they were under Zlatan. But they still haven't addressed the defensive issues well enough, in my opinion. We'll see. We'll see about the Galaxy. I think they're going to be a lot of fun to watch. I think Christian Pavone could be an MVP candidate, but I don't know if they're a cup contender because of that defense. So that's a lot of teams. That's a lot of different teams. That's not even getting into Minnesota, which I think is right there. Luis Amaria should be a more productive option up top than what they've had in the past. They should be as strong as they were defensively last year. I like their central midfield with Osvaldo Alonso and Jan Gregus. If Amaria is the guy that Minnesota thinks he is, they'll be in this mix. So that's a ton of different teams. It's going to be a really fun season in MLS. If I had to pick two right now that I think in late February are the two to be in MLS Cup, I will go with Atlanta and Sporting Kansas City. And I know the Sporting pick, a lot of people are going to say, what? I think Sporting has the type of talent and the balanced talent to get there at the end. And until we see what LAFC does with their roster defensively, until we see what Seattle does in totality defensively, until we see if the Galaxy can defend, I think Sporting might be the most balanced team out west as we sit on February 26th. Golden Boot winners, potential winners anyway. I think the obvious candidates, you know, Chicharito, Joseph, Vela. I really do like Jossie Zardes as a potential Golden Boot winner because I think Columbus is going to score a bunch of goals and he's going to be the primary option. He's going to benefit from great wing play from Pedro Santos, from Luis Diaz, who was really good for them late last season, and a playmaker in Lucas De La Raya. I think Zardes is going to have just a ton of opportunities to score goals, and I think he will. I think he'll be very, very good, and he'll be in the Golden Boot race. I think Pulido will be in that Golden Boot race as well. MVP candidates, I think Christian Pavon, if the Galaxy end up having the year that they could, Pavon would be a big part of that. I think Pity Martinez is a player who will be a big part of that race if Atlanta has the year that they could. In Kansas City, who would be that guy? It could be Alan Pulido because I think he's going to score a boatload of goals. It could be a Johnny Russell, who I really like, and I think you're going to get the best out of Johnny Russell now that he has a number nine to play off of to distribute to, but also I think Russell will find some goals for himself. I think Maxi Morales for New York City will be in that mix as well. Maxi Morales had one of the great underrated seasons in MLS history last year, almost getting to 20 assists. I don't see any reason why he couldn't do the same thing again. So it's going to be a fun season of MLS. I can't wait for the whole thing to get started. I've had a great time talking to you guys about Atlanta United, about MLS. If you want more from me, you can check me out on Twitter at Longshoe. You can check out our Atlanta United broadcast on 92.9 The Game on the radio.com app. You can also listen to my show, Soccer Down Here. It's 9 to 11 every morning on the East Coast. You can listen to it on soccerdownhere.net. We have a Soccer Down Here app. You can also listen on the Spreaker platform. So thanks, y'all, and can't.
And there you have it. Like Jason said, check him out on all those different platforms over there. Good luck on the call against Nashville. Let's kick off the season with a good W. And thank you so much for coming on. Wanted to have you on for a while, and I'm glad we can put it off right before MLS season kicks off. And for all my regulars out there, thank you so much for being subscribers. For all the new folks tuning in for the first time to listen to Jason and get a preview of MLS, make sure you hit that subscribe button on Elite Fantasy Podcast. We have some big things coming up with this channel specifically, so subscribe here. As always, I'll have a DFS article out on Thursday detailing this weekend's EPL action, cheat sheets out on Friday, and I'll see you guys in the chat room on Saturday morning. That's going to do it for episode 52 of the Talking Soccer Podcast. It's your boy Duke. Adios.